I apologize ahead of time for the noise. We have a wrapper. Well, we had a wraparound driveway in our backyard, and for the last week or so, they have been jackhammering, which is awesome for recording videos.
Yeah,
and they've been jackhammering and breaking up concrete, and today they're here breaking up the rest of it and hauling it away. So there's like three big machines back there making noise.
Mm.
So anyway.
I'll, there's three big the machines right here making shake noise. A little bit.
Well, yeah, that's true. They're, the whole thing will probably be shaking. You'll hear some rattling. I apologize. Can't do anything about it. But I've been shooting some of the course videos finally. Finally got started on that, which is really cool. And it's moving along, which is nice. But I have to do it around jackhammering. It's like this gap in between when the jackhammers go and then when the kids get home from school. I have this little window, and that's when I have to record. So that's what I've been doing.
3 minutes.
Yeah, it's not very long.
That's how long a module is. So just
I mean, yeah, kind of.
Just nail get it right on your first try.
The first try, and yeah. I'm doing it differently this time. I don't know if we talked about this or not, but I took so the first course was I had an outline, and I would look at the outline, get it in my head, and then I would talk to the camera like I do with normal videos. I don't script anything, and I would just talk and kind of do the screen capture at the same time. And then we ended up going back and redoing the screen capture after the fact to make it a little bit more concise stuff. And so for this time, the course is basically the same, except we're adding things to it. But everything that was there is just being updated for how Fusion is now. So the menus have changed, and you know they've added some stuff here and there. So I took the old script, we did a transcription of the old course, got all that text, and I've been going through it a piece at a time and reading it out loud, doing the thing on Fusion, and changing what needed to be changed. And so I've kind of like modified the script and made it, gotten rid of all my, not all of, a lot of my so's and now's, you know, things like that. Tried to make it a little bit more. And so this time, I'm reading through an updated script instead of just doing it off the top of my head. And I was talking... Oh, can you hear the... Can you hear that rattle?
Very faintly.
Okay. Man, it feels like my whole house is shaking. I was talking to Forby yesterday. He started editing the first sections of it, and he was like, this takes at least half the time. Like, this is so much faster because I'm not saying it one way and get to the end and be like, oh, maybe I should have said this instead. I've already done that work in the scripting. And I've never been one to script for videos and stuff, but I definitely see, you know, how it would be helpful. It's just not how I typically do things. But so it's moving along faster than the first one did, which is really cool. But I've still got a whole lot to do. Anyway, that's what I've been doing. What have you been up to this week?
This weekend, I went to the stained glass class at the Maker Camp, and I have a full video of that, which I'm trying to decide whether it should be public or Patreon. I'm putting it together now. A lot of background noise, so there's lots of people talking and machines going, so I might do a voiceover for that. But the stained glass was fun. There was an instructor came and taught that. People ask all the time, so just to clear it up. I don't do classes at the house anymore, not since COVID came and went. And besides, it was fairly complicated when I did that here. And so when Maker Camp came along, right around the beginning of 2019, I moved. Well, Austin asked if he could have the classes because he knew that I was really not really gung-ho on doing them anymore. So Austin does the classes. It's still here in East Durham. I go and participate in nearly every single one of them. And they happen at the Maker Camp, where there's a hotel and a dining hall and lots of more accommodations to help with a group of people. And so anyway, we did the stained glass was the first one of the season. Then there's leather and blacksmithing, all kinds of things. You can go to the Maker Camp website to look that up. But the stained glass was fun. When I have people here at the house, usually the whole house just gets completely consumed by everybody. We had Dave Daugherty, who you got to check out, and Derek from Malden. They were both here. We did the stained glass class together. And then in the evenings, we fiddled around with the Cadillac. So I got nothing done as far as the YouTube channel, which is fine. To hit an obligation of getting a video in January, Monday and Tuesday, I made this set of twin stools, leather and steel, which I posted last night. So that's why I put out a video oddly in the middle of the week. It's just to fulfill the obligation of getting a video out in January. So I did this quick video of leather and steel. It's something in my notebook, and inspired by Taylor, my friend Taylor Forrest, and she gave me the thumbs up, similar in design to what she's done, but a little bit different. And it's in the comment section. A couple of people like, this looks like Taylor's work. Similar but different. Like I said, she gave me the thumbs up on it. She was cool with it. And so now I'm going to be making these cast apples. I showed them on Patreon. So today, since my week, basically today is my Monday, since my video obligation is fulfilled, I'm going to start working on these apples, and I'm going to cast that as zinc. And I already made one, and my patrons seen it. I did a little quick video, and it's for a client. We're making an award, and I'll say who it is in time. I don't think it's appropriate to say it, but it's going to be an award, and they're called steel apples, but they're really made out of zinc, so they mimic steel, because I can heat that up and pour that here in the shop. And that's what I'm going to be working on for the rest of the day. I might show some stories on that. But these apples, I was kicking around the idea of, I made one sample already, so I know how to do it. It was successful. But I was thinking about casting an apple so I have like a perfect form, because I have to do sand casting. And then I made the first one perfectly with a regular apple. So this morning I went to the supermarket and I bought a bunch of apples just to use as form. So instead of making an apple that is always my form, I'm just using nature as my form. So I'm going to make the Apple Awards straight from apples as my casting pattern.
Could you take a bite out of an apple and then cast it?
I'm sure,
make the form out of it?
I'm sure you could, but with sand casting, you have a limited ability to pull out of the mold without damaging the mold. If it was a silicone, I thought about this too, with certain levels of heat with casting materials. Say, for instance, I'm using zinc, so it's like custom jewelry type metal. It melts at 400 degrees. I can pour that into a silicone mold, then I could put anything I want in it. But the silicone mold starts to deteriorate after a few heats. Especially it's 5 pounds of zinc, and with that 5 pounds of heat takes a really long time to cool, so the whole time it's cooking your silicone. So I could probably get one or two castings out of a $200 mold. So that's why I'm just gonna stay with the sand. But if you wanted to do one good rendition of an apple with a bite in it, cast in, you could do that, or you could do ceramic mold, which is something I wanted to do this year. So I'm going to experiment with making a ceramic mold. I have all the materials to do that. That's how they would have done bronze sculptures. Do you know, this is just a quick little fact, when they make a bronze sculpture, say, for instance, of a man on a horse, right? They make that in clay. They'll make it in clay, then they'll make a mold of it in wax, and then they cut that wax up into moldable pieces. It could be 100 pieces, and each one of those pieces gets molded and then welded back together to make that hollow casting of a giant man on a horse. Dang. It's an insane process that I just can't believe actually gets done. Like a good example here in New York would be the bull that's down on Wall Street, which, by the way, was placed by a rogue art team, and it's been sitting there ever since. It's been like 40 years it's sitting there.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was made by a rogue art team. It was just an Instagram story about it. The guys that made it are still around. They made it as some sort of something having to do with Wall Street, bullish Wall Street, and they made it in the 80s and placed it there one night, and right where they placed it is where it's been sitting ever since. It was never... what do you need? You get a permitted or whatever like that. It was never permitted or asked for. But because it was so huge and interesting, they said, all right, let's leave it. But for instance, that type of thing was molded, maybe made in wax, and then each section is cut up, and then each section is molded and then welded together. And sometimes if you see a big cast iron, or rather a cast bronze sculpture, if you take a close look at it, you could start to see where the dividing lines are, where the weld joints are. Anyway, I was always amazed when I found out about that. I'm sure there's various techniques, but when the bigger it is, they have to do it in pieces.
There's a local sculpture artist here. He did a Gandhi sculpture, brass Gandhi. And my grandfather, they used his hand and arm as the Gandhi's arm. So,
no way.
Like you were saying, just one piece at a time. And when Grandpa passed, there were some castings of his arm and hand, and I wanted one, but they went to his sons and daughters. But it was really cool to see how that works. And I didn't know that it was done one piece at a time. And I've been over there when they've done brass casting and with the for a different sculpture, but just to see the whole process of the wax and the different molds it takes to make this one thing, it's a lot of work, and it takes a team of people to do the pouring and the lifting.
Tremendous amount of work. Yeah,
it's crazy, and this has been around for 1500 years.
Yeah,
maybe longer.
It's wild,
long time. Yeah.
I wonder if you could mold and cast those pieces of your grandfather's arm. Like, if they have them, you know, they don't necessarily have to, like, lose them for you to also have one, which is kind of a neat thing.
I never thought about that. That would be really cool. I would love that. Yeah.
Just talking about artists. So, this week I was at dinner with my kids, and we were talking about something. We were talking about Chinatown. They were like, what is Chinatown? I'm like, oh, there's like a really awesome Chinatown in San Francisco that I went to and I spent some time in. And I was like, oh, I saw a Banksy there. And they were like, what's a Banksy? I'm like, dang it. All right. I have not raised you well. So I go and get my Banksy book and I pull it out and I'm like, this is who Banksy is. And I start showing them all this work. And it was really, really fun. I had not ever thought about the fact that I would get to introduce an artist that they knew nothing about. They knew nothing about the style, the motivations, the fact that nobody knows who this guy is, all of these things were brand new to them. And it was really fun to just flip through this book and then look at stuff and laugh and then look at stuff and be like, what does that mean? And look at stuff and like, why is the girl holding the gun and the balloon or the, whatever, you know, whatever the combination is. It was really cool. We spent a good, I don't know, 40 minutes or so just flipping through this book and looking at Banksy stuff. And then I got to tell him about the painting that like cut itself up when it came out of the frame, and they were blown away with like, why would you do that? I'm like, he's an artist. They're weird. I don't know. It's just like, it's part of the art, you know? It was a fun evening that I wasn't really expecting. I was just trying to tell them, I saw a Banksy painted on the side of this building and they had it covered up with plastic so nobody would mess it up. And
that's cool. Yeah, I saw a Banksy in person once hanging in a bathroom. When I did the TV show at NBC, and one afternoon Nick and I had lunch, and he's like, oh, let's stop at my friend's place, this artist somewhere in the LA like warehouse district, and the guy had a beautiful art set up, and he was a bronze caster, so we talked a little bit about what we just talked about, and he said he helped Banksy make something, and I said, you met him? He's like, yep. I go, you know what he looks like? He goes, yep. And I said, wow, that's pretty cool. I said, he helped him make a famous piece, which it escapes my mind. It wasn't there. It was just something we talked about. And long story short, he says his payment for me to help him with that bronze was the picture hanging in the bathroom. So of all the places when you stand at the toilet, you get to look at the Banksy. He said, I thought it would be the most perfect place for it. It's an image in a frame. But it looks just like his murals.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, you see people will cut out sections of a wall where there is one of the paintings. Or like what Bob saw, you'll see plexiglass over top just to preserve them. Yeah.
It was cool because I saw this in San Francisco. And it was the one, I don't know if you've seen it, it's the doctor with the stethoscope up against the wall. And there's a big heart and a peace sign. And it was on the side of like a little market or something, you know. But I remember this picture. I remember walking up and finding it and trying to figure out why it was there and stuff. And I know, obviously, I was in San Francisco. But as I was telling the kids about this, I'm like, when was that? Like, why? I've been to San Francisco many times, but I don't know when that was, why I was there, whether it was for work or Maker Faire. But I was walking around by myself, and so it couldn't have been with Maker Faire because I'm never by myself at Maker Faire, you know. And so I started going through pictures. And I'm going backwards in time and like looking at every picture I have from San Francisco, which is a lot. And I saw a whole bunch of you guys, which was really cool to see like when we met up at Maker Faire out there different times. And then I was just going back through time and I found a bunch from us, you know, in Chicago having dinner together and stuff and going to the different things. It was kind of neat going back. I wasn't expecting to have all these memories of the different places the three of us have been together, but I ran into a bunch of pictures. That was pretty cool. And I never did find the picture of the Banksy. So, I don't know. I've got it somewhere, but I don't remember when it was. It had to have been when I was doing software stuff. Because we would go out and meet up in San Jose at our office out there with all the people that were remote. And a couple of times we went into San Francisco for like user group meetings, and there was like a, you know, user conference or something. And so it must have been that, but that would have been probably 2013, 2014. So I don't know. Never could find it. But anyway, that's the end of that story because I couldn't find it. David, what have you been doing?
So I just finished up this art piece. Speaking of artists, this one is dedicated and inspired and a tribute to David Lynch, one of my all-time favorite artists of all time. And I think I talked up a little bit about it last week, but it's been so cold that I haven't been out into the shop. And so I finally finished this up yesterday. And I took a photo of them that I found and then traced it in Illustrator and made it into the silhouette and then cut it out on the scroll saw. And I could have easily cut this out with a laser or a CNC, but I thought it's more interesting if I use the scroll saw. It just makes for a better video. And I realized there's basically, it took me 2 hours to cut this out. An experienced scroll saw artist could probably do it in 30 minutes, but I don't have any experience with the scroll saw. So it took me 2 hours and it came out great. And what I realized is 2 hours of scroll saw footage is just as boring as 2 hours of CNC footage. It's all the same thing.
Yeah. Like,
all you need is 30 seconds and you get it. I still feel better about it because it was more of a hands-on experience and I got to learn a new tool.
It is more fun though, seeing the eye-hand coordination happen. So if you take a 20-minute CNC cut or a 20-minute thing and you make it 10 seconds or less, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so
I thought you were going to say, like, you know what I learned? I hate the scroll saw because like 2 hours, that would make me hate it.
It actually was the complete opposite. I went in expecting to not enjoy the scroll saw because
it's very relaxing.
It's just, it's so much.
Good image.
When you have I've never had a good scroll saw until now, and it's the Harbor Freight Bauer one, and it's got a huge 22-inch throat. So I could, and I got this one just so I could do a bigger piece. And when it's dialed in and you have the right blade, and you have music playing in your headphones, it is so relaxing and it is enjoyable. And I didn't think I was going to like it. I thought I was going to be very bored with it. But when it's working, it's just, it's meditative and it's kind of fun. And I can see why, I now understand why people love scroll saw art and just use a scroll saw. It's the same thing of like, the people who only have a lathe and are really good at the lathe. And it was actually very fun. And I could see myself doing more of this in the future.
You just have to figure out a way to film it to make the effort interesting like for the video.
So we did, we've got straight top-down shots, which look really cool on a scroll saw, because when you have this big 22 by 22-inch piece that you're twisting and turning into the blade, that looks really cool. And there's more to this piece than just the scroll saw part. There's vacuum press veneering, and it didn't come out the way I wanted to at first, so I modified it and tried to... I use India ink to dye a lot of the parts black, and then I thought, well, I'm going to sand away some of the India ink so it reveals some of the wood underneath, and I didn't like that, and I switched it back and forth, and then there's paint splatters on the thing. It's a whole thing, and so luckily, it's more than just 2 hours of scroll saw work. There's a whole story of how I was introduced to David Lynch, and I think a lot of people know David Lynch as the weird filmmaker, and I see David Lynch more as a sculptural artist and a painter and a photographer because those, I enjoyed those, his art more than his filmmaking. Although I do enjoy his filmmaking, I just don't quite understand it. And that's the way he liked it.
Right.
He's famous for not explaining why he did things. So he's done a ton of interviews over his life, and somebody like, what's it mean when you did this? Or I don't understand the end. He was just like, that's for you to decide. And it's not for me to tell you. And one of the interesting things in one of the interviews that I saw was the having a movie where you don't understand the ending, or there's not really an ending, that movie lives on in your head. So the movie never ends. And he really enjoyed that.
That's
interesting. You know, as a viewer, I always found that annoying. And it's like, oh, there's no, you don't have that satisfaction of knowing exactly how that story ended. But after hearing that, I appreciate it a little bit more.
It's funny because when I went to go see, at the time, this is 30 years ago, Mulholland Drive was all the rage in the Lower East Side. Everyone was talking about Mulholland Drive. So I went to go see it with some friends. And I left there. I go, could anybody explain to me what we just watched? I said, because that was not a great experience. And everyone's like, well, what it was this. And I was just like, then why don't they just explain that? No, well, it was going to be blah, and then it was going to be blah.
If you...
I don't get it.
Friends just sound like a bunch of Muppets.
Yeah.
So you, if you, we just recently watched Mulholland Drive, and of course we were like, I don't understand what we just watched. So the next morning I went to YouTube and looked for explanations on Mulholland Drive, and the explanations are just as confusing as the movie.
Well, and when she did this and then she got into the car.
Yeah, they're like 20-minute long. There's a couple videos and they're like 20 minutes long. And my head was spinning. And some of the things were like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Now I get it. And then some of the things were just like, I'm still confused. Your explanation confused me even more because it's just so weird and everything twists on top of each other. But once you kind of realize like, oh, this is real. In the movie, this is real. This is a dream. This is a dream within a dream. It's thick and layered.
I have never seen it, but it sounds like I will be confused. So I'm not sure that I'll watch it.
The funny thing is, it's like so many film critics consider it one of the best movies ever. Like I think it's number one on the BBC top movies of all time.
Jeez.
When you watch it, as somebody who just watches movies for entertainment, you're like, how did this make this list? I'm confused. And I think a lot of times just pretentious movie critics like to be pretentious movie critics and just enjoy something that can't be explained. And I say
like
that
they
with
understood
love.
It and they're the ones that understood it.
Yeah.
That's what it's, yeah.
Yeah, I say that with love because I'm actually attracted to pretentious people. There's something about pretentious people that I enjoy. I seriously do. When you're really passionate about something and you think you're better, quote unquote, at this
particular
thing.
You would have enjoyed that movie with the friends I went to see it with.
I just like pretentious people. Maybe that's a reflection of who I am, but...
Unrelated. So I don't know why we're talking about movies. Well, I do know now, but I don't know why I'm going to continue to talk about movies. But have you guys ever seen the movie The Game with Michael Douglas?
A long time ago.
Okay, so
I think a long time ago.
I showed my kids this movie. I really like the movie, and I showed my kids. Now, this is a warning to anybody else with kids. It is an R-rated movie, so I'm not suggesting you show it to your young kids. My kids are teenagers, and we watch a lot of different things for different reasons. This movie is a very suspenseful movie, and I cannot tell you anything about it or it will give it away. Other than it was so much fun to watch my kids. And like I said, I'm not going to tell you what we're watching. It's just know that it's suspenseful and you won't understand it until the last scene of the movie. And they were like, what? And so then, you know, we get like 2 minutes into it and they're like looking at me. They're like, what is happening? What is going on? Who is that? Like, why is this? What? And then just the further it goes into it, you're just like, what? what is going on? And it was so fun to watch all four of them just kind of constantly be in, you know, these different
states. Is it about a video game? Is it about a kid sitting on the couch ordering pizzas and playing a video game?
No.
I don't think I've seen this.
You should see it. It's very good. It's not like, you know, I'm not saying it's a, I'm not doing the pretentious, it's the best movie of all time thing, but it is very interesting, and you really don't have any idea what's going on. And I saw it, like, it came out in the 90s, I think, and I saw it when it came out. And I hadn't seen it since, but I remember liking it a whole lot. And so this time, we got to the end of it, and the kids were like, well, why did it end up this way? Like, they understood the premise, but then they were like, well, why did, what was the point of all of these things? And without really thinking about it and never having thought about it before, I said, well, at the beginning, he was this way, and this happened, and this happened. But at the end, you saw that he changed from this to this and this, and these other things happened, and I, like, I understood the progression of characters that I hadn't kind of consciously thought about before, you know? So it was kind of neat watching it a second time, even though the suspense wasn't there. It was neat to, like, oh, wow, like, I actually learned something about why they made the movie the way they made it. So it was cool.
Kelly and I watch movies in a completely different way. She's always trying to figure out the ending or figure out what's going on. And I don't. My brain is not turning when I'm watching. I just watch, and I don't think she understands how I could just watch a movie without trying to figure out what's going on or the ending. But I'm just taking it as entertainment, and I'm just taking it in. But her brain is always moving, trying to understand or figure out or guess. I don't make any guesses.
Have you guys watched Disclaimer? Because I'm watching that right now with Rachel.
I have not.
And I never follow along, thank God for her, because she fills in all the gaps because I'm always like half asleep on anything we watch. But if you guys watch Disclaimer, we're watching the last episode, and there's a pretty crazy twist. I won't say it.
Okay. I know nothing other than the name of the show. Yeah. You just told me, so I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. I don't even know where it's on. I can't even turn my TV on anymore because... Anytime, Rachel's all into all this different stuff, so I actually haven't had a TV in 20 years until Rachel came into my life. She's like, do you have a TV? I said, I have one from my New York apartment in storage. And she's like, what's it going to take for you to get it and put it up? So we put it up, and then she puts the internet brick that like brings up all the television channels.
The internet brick.
How old are you, Jimmy?
Man.
Whatever it's called. Apple TV, I guess, maybe is what it is. And... all of a sudden, there's 400 choices and 17 things to sign into.
Yeah.
I could turn the TV on, and then it'll bring up just a black screen, but I can't do anything else. And then every time my hand goes near the controller, I'm like brushing away like what we're watching, or like I won't touch it. I was like, you touch that thing. Because half of it is a swipe pad with my big thumbs. It's really frustrating. So I still don't watch TV unless she's around. And we watched the first episode of The Penguin, which is pretty cool. Did you guys watch that?
I have not.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because it's obviously shot in New York, but it's supposed to be, I guess, Gotham City. And that's pretty cool. I can get into
that. If you like that, you should watch The Batman, like the movie that is before that. Like, people are going to be mad, but it's my favorite Batman. It is awesome.
Which one is that, the one with Heath Ledger?
No. It's called The Batman, and it's got Robert Pattinson as Batman.
Oh, okay.
And it's what I think of walking down a dark alley in New York City.
Yeah, because they mentioned Batman in this episode, but you don't see him.
It happened before that show. Anyway,
yeah, because I did see the Heath Ledger one. That's an old one, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a gripe that I just need to get this out there.
Uh-oh.
And I will never, ever, ever buy another LG television. Ever.
Really?
I have one, and it's about 2 years old. And every once in a while, a pop-up comes up on the screen saying, I don't even know what it's saying, but it's a pop-up. A TV should never, ever have a pop-up.
It's for advertisement, or is it telling you,
it's
like,
not
hey,
an advertisement. It's
giving
about,
you
like,
tips about the TV?
Something and we don't use the TV remote. It's stored away because we only use the Apple TV remote to turn everything on and off. So I gotta find this freaking remote to make the pop-up go, because it doesn't just go away. And then I realized, like, the the TV, depending on the content, will switch from like HDR to Dolby or whatever. And there's like a 2 second blackout when it switches. And I'm like, you know, yes, what? I'm just going to go set the TV to one and just leave it at that, so I don't get that 2 second blackout. And I went to go to this. So I get the remote out and I go to the settings and I can't change the settings because it says something about you need to connect to the internet before you can do any of this stuff. And are you kidding me? I don't want my TV connected to the internet. I don't want pop-ups.
I'm upset. Remember, Sam, once you had to program the TV. Remember the TV had like a bunch of little switches? That is when I disconnected from the television business, is when you had to program your channels and you do like the auto programming. I remember I bought a brand new TV from Best Buy when I lived in the city because the person I lived with needed a TV. I didn't, but that person did. And I got a TV, connected it, never turned it on because you had to program the channels. And ever since then, that was 20 years ago, ever since then, TVs have just been, forget it, have no interest in them.
A few years ago,
can't go near them, no technology, nothing.
A few years ago, I wanted a TV for the shop. And I had like in the Amazon, you know, Alexa or Fire TV box thing with, she just bonged. She didn't
say her name. I heard that, yeah.
And so I had that. I just needed a dumb TV. And at that point, it was really difficult to find a dumb TV that was basically just a monitor. I found one at Walmart, and it was like $200. And so I'm like, cool, I finally found the thing that I need that doesn't have all of the other stuff that you're talking about. I don't care what the color profile is and all of that. You know, it's just like I need a dumb TV for this one thing. I got it home and used it, but it was a huge pain in the butt. Because it, you know, everything now is made to respond to the input dynamically. So if you change the thing that's coming into it, the TV will select the right input, and the audio kind of like autos. All this stuff is set up to kind of help, even though there's pop-ups and a web interface and all this crazy stuff you don't need. So I had this TV for a couple of years, and it got to be so annoying because of the exact same reasons. And so I'm saying that, unfortunately, a dumb TV does not have fewer problems than a smart TV. They're just different problems. But every time I wanted to change the input, I had to go find this remote. Every time I wanted to change it, the volume would not transfer to the other remote of the device that I was using. So I had to use one for volume and one for, you know. So, and now I don't even think you can find them. Not at the big box stores anyway. I'm sure somebody makes them. But I do have an LG TV as well as our main TV in the house. And the kids play PlayStation on it. I play PlayStation on it too. But it constantly does that. It's an LG, and it does that 2 second flicker thing. Mm-hmm. And the PlayStation, probably most game consoles, will change their output type depending on what you're doing in the game. So you're like playing along and you go in a cave, and then it's like, oh, we should change the color profile. And then the TV blacks out for 2 seconds, and then when it comes back, you're dead and your stuff is all lost. And, you know. So
I just sent you guys a picture of a giant monitor that's sitting here in my office, which I have designs on one day hooking up and telecasting from the computer to it, which I've actually done, believe it or not, with a dongle. But this thing weighs like 4,000 pounds. That TV was getting thrown away at the World Trade Center when Patrick worked there.
Oh, I remember you talking about that.
Then he took it, yeah. We used to have it hanging in the big giant shop, but then when the TV show came along, we had to take it down. And just for safety reasons, so it wouldn't get damaged, I put it in this room, and I haven't touched it since because it weighs like probably weighs 200 pounds, which is really difficult to move alone. I'm going to have to make some crazy bracket to hang it on the wall. So one of these years, I'll do that. But that basically is a big giant monitor. It has it. You could have it profile or landscape. You could set it up any way you want.
So it's not a television. It just takes an input. It doesn't have all the other stuff.
Yeah, you can't put channels on it or anything, which is kind of cool because I hate having a program channel. So I'd rather just look at the thing turned off. So I know.
It's just a big box on the wall. I'd
rather look at the thing turned off.
Because that's my decision. That's how I know I want it to be.
Three old guys complaining about technology.
That's right. I couldn't find the remote. Well,
If I was tasked with finding any TV shows that we're in the middle of right now, I just wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't be able to turn the TV on. I wouldn't be able to find what channel it's on. Have no idea. No idea. So, like I said, if it wasn't for Rachel leading the way, I definitely would not watch any show ever.
And your life would be fantastic if you didn't watch the shows. You know what I mean?
I'm sleeping through half of it anyway. And it's funny, I remember every time my dad would take us to the movies, and this is how I am now, and I know why. The minute I stop moving, I'll start to fall asleep. I'm like a shark. Like, if I stop moving, if I give... And when I was a kid, my dad would take us to Disney movies. Occasionally, he would take us to movies that he wanted to see, like, for instance, like police chase movies. And I remember we went to see Bullet with Steve McQueen. Now, what year was Bullet? I was sitting in the movie theater watching Bullet with my brothers and my dad. We went to see Blazing Saddles. But every single time... I'd look over, my dad would have his head in his chest. He'd be totally sleeping. And I feel it's exactly the same way the minute I'm like tasked with having to sit down and watch TV.
Yeah, I think that happens to all of us.
Yeah.
I haven't told you about this this thing I'm doing. I mean, I texted you guys about it, but we haven't talked about it here. So this last week I put out the video of the webcam mount, which I'm using right now.
Yep.
And so I made this little webcam mount to be able to move the webcam down in front of the screen temporarily, and you could just lift it up and put it away. And so I, as I was finishing this thing up, I'm like, oh, these files are actually, like, these Fusion files are actually in pretty good shape. Like, I'm confident in them for the first time in a really long time. And so I thought, well, I'll just put these up for sale real cheap, and people can print their own. It's easy to put together. It just takes a couple screws. And so I put those files up, and then I'm like, you know, it actually doesn't take very long to print them. I may as well just put up, like, I took some pictures of the one that I had, and I put them up as a product. And I'm like, yeah, I could print these for people if anybody wants them. It's not a big deal. And I didn't really think about the fact that I was putting up a product that had to be manufactured and packaged and shipped, and that anybody would want them. And so I didn't say anything about it in the video. I just put the product up and linked it. When you go to the files, you can see, oh, you want one already printed? Just click here. And then I sold a bunch of them accidentally over the weekend.
Accidentally.
And so, and the files have sold really well.
You see, you're selling the object and the file.
And the files separately. And dawned on me when I texted you guys that, like, I have been talking for years about making a product, about designing something that could be broad appeal that other people could use, and I accidentally did it. And so over this last couple of days of this week, I didn't sell tons of them, but I sold more than I was expecting. So over the last couple of days, I printed a bunch of them, and then when I started to assemble them, I realized, like, oh, these screws are kind of hard to find in this length, so if I go in and I change this thing, then I can do this. Oh, and I forgot to put this thing on there, and I can adjust this. And so I've basically completely, not completely, but mostly redesigned the files for specific hardware to make them easier to assemble and stronger, and, you know, I got a little neoprene foam thing to put on the back of it so it doesn't scratch the monitor, and all these improvements have happened in the last couple of days, and then I figured out, like, how they would be shipped, and got a new shipping software so that I can print packing slips. And, you know, it's just like I fell down this hole really quickly. And so last night, these version 2 of all the files and everything, I printed 20 of them overnight while I slept. And so I woke up this morning thinking, like, that's wild that you can pre-sell something. I know this is not new to anybody else, so I recognize that I am just...
But having gone through the experience is great.
It's weird to, I had an idea, I did a thing, I iterated over a couple of days, I went to bed and woke up and there's 20 copies of the product sitting there.
Mm.
And the boxes are going to be here today, and so I'm going to start fulfilling those orders, and then tonight when I go to bed, I'm going to hit print again, and I'll wake up to 20 more of them tomorrow, and I'll have 20 more, or, you know, whatever I need to print.
Yeah.
But it's just really strange how we've talked about the product thing for so long. Like, I don't even know how many years I've been saying that. And then I kind of accidentally did it.
Yeah.
And then I got a bunch of feedback this morning. I made an Instagram story about it, and a bunch of people sending me, you know, comments about the design and about usefulness and all this type of stuff. It's really cool. And it was just kind of surprising. I caught myself off guard.
Have you thought about making the custom packaging where I don't know what it's called, but you take the thin layer of plastic over a mold and do the vacuum where it sucks
vacuum form shape.
Oh,
vacuum form. Yeah,
no,
that could be a That could be a fun project.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Well, part of the kind of adjustment in the design was it slides along the thing, and it pivots. And so depending on how you have the two pieces that move against each other, depending on how you have them sitting, it changes the dimension of the whole thing. You can make it long and skinny, or you can make it shorter but wider in one dimension. And I had to spend time yesterday thinking, like, okay, well, if I extend it out to its longest dimension, how much are boxes that would fit this volume? So I looked up those boxes and found a bunch of different quotes, and then I went back and changed the volume of it so it was shorter, but it was wider, and then I had to go look up those dimensions and find which boxes, you know, would be the best fit for that. It was just
Are you buying boxes that you line?
Not yet. I was going to, and I actually found them cheaper on Amazon for the specific one that I wanted to get, and I don't need to buy, like, thousands of them or anything. Yeah. I'm sure that is something that we'll have to adjust, but just trying to figure out which box will be the simplest to put together, you know, which stainless steel little pin is the right diameter, and, you know, how do I get these in most efficient cost per item, and how quickly can I get them, and then which screw is the right screw to put in the thing, and, you know, it's just been a bunch of little types of things that in the past when we've done, like when we were doing our push sticks, Josh spent a lot of time sourcing materials and researching boxes and figuring out but it was like weeks or a couple of months of preparation to launch that thing, and this was 2 days of, oh, I forgot to do the thing, I didn't think about this, I gotta do that, you know. So it's been cool, it's been fun and interesting, and today I have to do a bunch of packaging.
I show this online, you guys probably already know this, but I design my own boxes whenever I make a leather thing, and I buy a pallet leather. I buy 3 by 4 foot pieces of, not leather, but of corrugated. And I just throw them on the laser cutter. I make one box. Anything I cut is usually, first round is usable. So I'll make the first box so it's not a waste. I'll be able to use that box to ship something in. But each time I make it, I can refine the pattern just a little bit more. And in fact, the other day, my brother came up here and we spent the day developing a product he came up with. And a lot of it has to do with the package itself. And so I showed it on my Patreon, what I was working on, but I didn't say what the product was just yet because it's my brother's idea. And I designed everything in Illustrator, and we designed the packaging and everything and laser cut it out. And within just the end of the day, we had 3 or 4 prototype packages, product inside, everything done, soup to nuts, all logo, everything. It's really an amazing time. And it's funny because when my brother and I started in the toy business in 1990, there was a person in New York, I think his name was Art B. I don't know what his last name was, but Art B was like the packaging guy. You weren't allowed to think of a package unless Art did it for you. You couldn't even bring, you had to let Art do it. And Art had the monopoly on the toy business of designing. And it's like Art has a software where you could actually like lay it out. Never thought to use Illustrator at the time. I was going to call. Sorry, I blocked the camera off for a second.
You turned off your camera instead of your microphone.
Shut off my vision and then cough. But Joe said, do you remember when Art B had the stranglehold on the packaging business in the New York City area? It was crazy because all the toy companies went to him and his staff to design and develop packages. And it's crazy, just with a couple. I've showed it on Patreon a few times, how to just whip up an Illustrator file. It might always need adjustments, but the more you get to understand the material you're using, you know where to put the reliefs and make things a little bit wider for double folds and stuff. And it's really quick and easy. So with the leather, my main leather tote, I don't like it shaking around because it could potentially scratch in the packaging. So I made a package that just snugly holds it, so I don't have to put any packing in there because the leather itself is somewhat durable. Put it in there with a duster, like a bag over the bag itself to prevent scratching, that I make out of soft cotton, and then I put it in the bag, in the box, and it's just firmly fit. But for me to go to McMaster and try and then get a box that's close with some airspace in it,
yeah.
And plus I could also put my logo in it, so I laser etch my logo into it as well.
We've done that before, made our own boxes for, like Josh made some packaging for a really cool product that we never released. Mm-hmm. and I have a stack of corrugated sheets, like uncut sheets, and they're still plastic wrapped. So I totally could have done what you just talked about, and yeah. I didn't even cross my mind. I mean, it would have been one more thing to figure out, along with all these other things I've had to figure out in the last few days. So it's still something I can do. But
yeah, I know you're totally capable of it. That's just why I'm kind of reminding you, like, don't forget you have these skills. Because what's interesting, I like to think that when I develop and send a product out to somebody, they know right down to the handwritten address, because I still don't have a computer program. Even Derek yells at me. He's like, go get the post office app. It takes 2 seconds. And I'm like,
yeah, you would save a lot of time with that.
I mean, I like the idea of sitting down. The idea of me handwriting it with a Sharpie on an index card that becomes my address label versus typing it. I have to read it 3 times. I have to make sure I'm not inverting numbers. If I typed it, it's the same thing. I got to type it. I got to look at it. I literally look at this. I look at the screen, then I look at my phone, then I look at the screen, I look at this, and like the 5th time I realize I inverted numbers. I don't see it right away, so it takes me a long time to really. The other day I got a message from Roy, my buddy Roy, who does the Vintage Axe Works, and he's like, hey, I never got my wallet. And I was like, oh, I must have got lost. Don't worry, I'll package up and send you another one. And I go in the post office, they're like, hey, this got returned, and it's the same exact package I'm bringing in to send. I inverted the post office number, which by the way, I said, I go, shouldn't you guys have picked it up? Because they always type it in anyway. I'll bring it in handwritten and then they'll type it in anyway. But if I got the post office app, it would have curtailed that. Anyway, I sent Roy 2 packages and I readdressed the one that I sent and the one I had with me. So I said, you're getting 2 wallets in short.
So when you handwrite it, you have 2 failure points. You have your failure point and then the post office who could potentially put it in the wrong. Will you download the post office app, please?
Between seriously. Last year's Christmas and this year's Christmas, sending out packages, it was the only one that got returned. This is the one to Roy.
So one thing that's kind of interesting about, I use stamps.com. I wish they were sponsoring. That'd be cool. But I use that, and I think most of the different applications will have address verification. So as you type in the thing, when you go to the next screen, it verifies with the USPS the address.
Yeah, so do they. That's why, because she'll type in, she or him, whoever's at the counter, will type it in, and they'll be like, oh, okay, I see it. And but that particular day, I don't know why they didn't get it. I said, shouldn't somebody have picked it up? And Joe, the guy who works there, is like, yeah, that should have been picked up by us. He goes, it's our fault and your fault. I was like, no big deal. But the point
is my fault, but also your fault.
The bigger point is that it's the experience of getting every single thing handmade by me. Now, that obviously can't scale. Last year, I sent out about 75 packages, and every single one I handmade, packaged, wrapped, hand-addressed, every single one. And I always write a note on one of the flaps, so when you open the box, there's a note there on the flap. So every single one I made last year. So the idea, I don't know if I ever got to the point where I just couldn't handle that anymore. They trickle in. You know, the orders trickle in. So as they come in, I immediately put them out instead of waiting. As soon as it comes in, I know which product I have, which is available. It's usually bespoke, so it's like, hey, you posted today, do you have that color? I said, I still do, or it's gone, or whatever. So I jump on it right away, so that the next person comes in and says, hey, do you still have that color? I go, nope, just sold it. So I got to be on it, which I haven't promoted any of my leather stuff since Christmas, but I will get back to it when it warms up a little bit, because all my leather stuff is in the unheated barn, which is just too cold to be in.
So with this whole process, like, I've seen a lot of people in our space who sell, you know, their own products, and I've seen on Instagram, like Drew Witt and Travis from Shop Nation and people like that, who they do pretty high volume, or it seems like they do high volume of the thing that they sell. And so they've automated a lot of that process to print out labels and print out packing slips and, you know, do all this stuff. And it all seems really... It seems like there's a lot to that, to get that set up. And so I've never, before this, shipped enough things from my house to where it's inconvenient to do it a little bit more manually. You know, I still print out labels, but it's still kind of like one-off. You know, somebody orders plans, I print the thing, and I, whatever. And so with this, I said, well, if this thing continues to sell to any degree, I need to make this faster for myself. So I spent, like, I don't know, 30 minutes or something looking into how these people do a more efficient way. And I'm like, oh, well, they use this piece of software and that makes it easy. Mm-hmm. Probably should have done that a long time ago. So, you know, again, it just was taking the minute to actually look into how to do something. Turns out it's not really as complex as I thought it would be. And it's going to end up saving me time, probably. Costing a little bit of money, but saving a little bit more time. If it's something that I continue to have to do on a regular basis. I also, this is weird how the timing worked, but last week, Joel from 3D Printing Nerd, you guys know Joel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Joel posted a video that I guess he made a long time ago about upgrading his print farm. So he has a print farm, and I don't remember how many printers he had originally, but he posted this video of him getting in, I can't remember how many, it's like 36 or 40 printers to completely replace all of the printers in his print farm, and they're all Prusa printers. And so it's him just getting in these boxes and showing the unboxing and the setup and how you get them all connected to be able to print, you know, products at a scale like that. And watching him do this, each one of those printers is $1,000 at least. And watching him do this and set it up and then get all of the connectivity between all of them, I was thinking, like, good grief. The amount of money, the amount of power that it would take to get all that stuff, and the amount of upkeep to keep that number of machines running to be able to print things on a regular basis. And then, like, Travis from Shop Nation, he keeps making his print farm bigger, and he gets like 20 or 30 Bamboo Labs printers at a time, and just, you know, I don't know how much of that is me seeing the same types of things over and over on social media, and how much, you know, it's like anything that seems bigger or more impressive or more expensive or more whatever on social media, but the step into having your own any scale print farm or any scale laser business, you know, where you have more than one machine and you have orders that you're constantly manufacturing and shipping out in this kind of circle, it seems pretty wild. And when you watch people like the two of them, and then there's some other people on Instagram that I see that just giant warehouses full of 3D printers, and they're managing every single one of them to print products, and it's crazy. And I don't know that I want to go down that route completely, but it's really interesting to just barely dip my toes into it with the printers that I already have and see how it could, if things sold, it could be one of those things that grows and grows and grows, and then you end up with tons of infrastructure and tons of stuff that you have to maintain. And so,
but if you have a successful product.
Sure, yeah.
Then.
And it's also one of the things that I think is most interesting about that type of business, to me anyway, is that I could set it up, or any person could set up, could design the product, get the initial thing going, get the machine set up, and start printing them, and then you teach somebody else how to push the buttons and how to pack the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to do that anymore, but it can still get done. And so, it, you know, I guess that's the good and bad thing about digital fabrication, but it seems like a good thing to me. Anyway, it's something that I'm just, you know, beginning to think about, and
It's so accessible to everybody. You just got to find that one interesting thing that you're either happy making and also will sell. You know, you could sell something that you're not interested in making, and it just wouldn't be fun. Dave,
I was going to say, have you thought about a version 2? Are there ideas floating in your head?
Or a 1.2? I think 1.1. There's probably some additions. I think it needs to be a little bit longer for taller monitors, and I think the little hook on the bottom of it that keeps it on top of the monitor could be better, could be just more usable. And so there are some changes to it, and I'm not sure when I will actually try to put those in place.
Bob, this is what everybody says to me about the leather. They go, you need a line. You need a line look. You need accessories. You need a line. You need three price points. I'm like, relax. I made another bag that I
take
sold
it easy.
10 of. Yeah. Relax. You need a line look. You need line sheets. You need retail, wholesale. But I'm like, no. You're immediately taking something that's interesting and fun, and you made it unfun. Thank you for your opinion.
I mean, I think that stuff makes sense when you're ready to go, here's somebody else, I'm going to pay you to make all those things and do all of the thing, which doesn't work in your case. It's like a handmade leather bag.
It happens like naturally. It happens naturally. And going into this Christmas, I came up with a couple of new ideas. I have a couple ideas on the computer, which I haven't been able to cut out yet. But I have ideas, and it happens naturally. And then people go, oh, you're really making a beautiful line. I'm like, I'm just having fun. I'm not overthinking it. Making a beautiful line look.
What in the world? I just got a... I guess this is a scam thing.
I sent it to you.
It's like from PayPal saying that I requested money from a fashion center.
Oh, man. The PayPal scams are getting out of control. I'm getting them. They look super real.
I keep getting the Venmo one where it's so-and-so's requested $500 for something such. And then I go right to Venmo. I don't click, of course, on anything in any email ever. Even with people I know, I just write back. I don't click on anything anymore. I go, if you want me to see a picture, just send me a screen grab of it that's in the email. Otherwise, I won't look.
Just send me an email of a screen grab of an email. Yeah, that'll exactly. Make it legit.
No, if I could tap on the email and open it up and see it versus having to click a drop down, that's never happening.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to look at this and see what is going on here.
Are we okay? Are we clear? Or do we not need a topic?
I mean, we're like an hour
I've been really
in.
Freaking out, like stressing about. I don't think we have a topic.
We talked about TVs for a little while, and we talked about
TVs and self products.
Yeah.
Okay. So we don't need a topic today.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I think we did.
Thank goodness.
The name of the episode could be the little box that goes near the TV.
The black box.
Yeah.
I mean. Yeah, for me, the last week has been a lot of interesting, that new stuff that I just talked about. And I haven't gotten anything done other than course stuff. I do have an interesting project coming up for a friend of mine. I'm not going to talk about it yet, but it's something pretty different for me. And it's building it's for a game, like a physical game. And it's basically a play area for a game that I don't know. But it's big. So I'm designing and
it's like environmental design kind of thing, like a
kind of
like a pen, like at a McDonald's kind of comparison,
something like that. Yeah. And so I'm trying to figure out how to build this big thing. It's not complicated or anything, but make it so that it can come apart in pieces and it can be stored away and it can be moved, but it has to be durable. And you know, so it's kind of an interesting thing I'm gonna have to dig into in the next couple of weeks. But we'll talk about that more.
I totally missed out on what could have been a great YouTube video, at least. Like from a storytelling perspective, so I think it's too late because I can't go back and get the footage that I needed. But I recently came across a Juno 106, which is a 1984 synthesizer, and it's a famous synthesizer. It's highly sought after for its sound and simplicity and looks, and it's all analog. And I've always wanted one, but I've never pursued it because they're stupid expensive. And I saw an estate sale, and I saw a photo of one in this estate sale. And I was like, we had a vet appointment in the morning, and I was like, Kelly, any way you could take the dog to the vet appointment, going to work late, because I think I need to go to this estate sale. Actually, she volunteered. She saw my excitement, and she volunteered. and so I go there 2 hours early. This estate sale was, like, crazy. There were hundreds of shoes in organized bins and everything. So this was a sneakerhead and a big video game nerd. And so I get there 2 hours early. Yeah. Yeah, those things are hard to think about. I did look up this person afterwards. But so I get there 2 hours early, and you get a number. It's like a deli-style number thing. And there's a bunch of people in line. I'm actually 18th, but everybody's there for the shoes and the video games. And I go down there, and there is this Juno 106. And I didn't know what the price was going to be, but I knew they sell for $1,000 broken. Just for parts. $1,000 just for a broken one for parts. So I'm like, if it's under that, I'll just get it, and then I'll just get my money back. And it was listed as $600. I could see that the panel was open. It was missing the side pieces, and it had no caps on the sliders, and a couple of the sliders looked like they were missing. I was like, I'll grab it. And I grabbed this $600 synth. I take it back home. It didn't have a power cable. I solder. I cut up an extension cable. I solder one in there, and I plug it in, and it freaking works. And I was like, this is... That's awesome. Amazing. And then the broken sliders, I could get in there with a toothpick and move them around. And finding one that completely works is around $2,500 USD. And it doesn't have the side panels, and I'm going to make the wooden side panels for it. And I got a couple of the new slider pots. They're arriving today. I'm going to solder them in. But it was like a totally missed opportunity, because if I would have, like... You know, there's the YouTubers that film all every day of their lives, and just in case. And if I would have filmed me and all the people going into this house for this crazy estate sale, and how I was like the first one into the music room and grabbed the synth right away, if I would have had like a body cam footage, it would have been amazing. I could have shown me making the side panels and soldering the new things, and it would have been a great video, but it's not.
Well, I mean, what about if you did, like, a reenactment of that first part? Because that's the only part you can't, you know.
Right.
Or you could just tell the story. You're obviously excited about it.
I am excited about it, yeah.
You know?
I could.
You could. Yeah. You can tell that story and then make a silly reenactment of your excitement over it, or, I don't know, you figure out some way to do that.
Who's the animator guy that made our animations years ago? I need to contact that person.
Oh, yeah.
Remember? Those things were amazing.
I'm sorry
I forgot your name, but the person that did the animations of us taking clips of the podcast and making animations, if you're still out there and you want to make some money.
Somebody, contact. I remember he did something about the square. I couldn't find the square. He took something where I said I have so many squares in the shop, they keep disappearing, and then I remember some animation about that.
There was a great one where I was telling the story of I was in the shower and the steam set off our smoke alarm thing, and I had to get out to shut the alarm off before the fire department showed up, but I didn't. As I was running naked and wet to the panel, I slipped and fell and smacked my toe, and I just remember, I'm choking on I'm choking up because this animation was so good. Anyway, I forgot your name. Contact me.
Well, yeah, let us know. Well, I'm going to thank our Patreon supporters. We've gone a long time without a topic, so we're grateful to them for being here to support the show, even though we don't always have topics. Especially top supporters: Nick Ryan, Corey Ward, Albers Woodworks, Works by Solo, Chad from Mancrafting, Rich at Low End Design, Odin Leather Goods, Sean Beckner, Scott at Dad It Yourself DIY, Jeff at the New Janky Workshop, Warren Works, Michael Manegin, Crabtree Creative, A Pretty Big Deal, and OMG Made. New patron on that list this week.
Thank you, guys.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. But there's a lot of other people as well that support the show at different levels, and they all get the after show. So if you want the after show, you got to go to patreon.com/makingit, join at any level whatsoever, and you'll have that separate podcast feed that you can put in your podcast player. And you'll also have the link to the YouTube video if you want to watch the after show on YouTube. And in case you don't know, the normal show is also on YouTube. So if you want to see us, you know, there's a disclaimer there because we're not great to look at, but if you want to see us, it's on YouTube, so you're welcome.
You can't see Jimmy Coffin though, because he shuts off his video when he calls.
<That's right>. Yeah, but big thanks to everybody that helps out the show on Patreon. We are super grateful for you all.
Thank you, so. Thank you.
Yep. You guys got anything to recommend this week?
I was looking at my history at watching The Essential Craftsman. If you guys haven't seen, The Essential Craftsman, he's still working hard, making good content, so check out The Essential Craftsman.
He's like the grandfather that, you know, if you didn't have that grandfather, that's the grandfather you wanted.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. David, what you got?
I'm going with Veritasium, a small and upcoming channel with just 17.1 million subscribers. Oh, but yesterday, he put out a video on Super Glue, and a lot of us makers need to watch this video. It's so good. It goes over the history, but it also goes over, of course, it's going to go over the science of super glue and why it's insanely strong one way but weak another way, how to unglue your fingers when you need to, and what it sticks to, what it doesn't. I think it's required viewing for all of us makers.
Cool. A few weeks back, we talked about, I don't remember who told who about him, but the channel, it's called Dave's Auto Center, I think?
Yeah.
It's called? Yeah. Really cool videos, and I think somebody sent it to me because he was talking about a Land Cruiser motor.
Mm-hmm.
And since that short that I saw, they did a video about beginning to machine an FJ40, like my green one, a motor for that. And then they put out a video a couple weeks ago, I sent it to you guys, and it's how to rebuild a Toyota 3FE engine, which is the engine that I've been trying to get rebuilt for 2.5 years in my white Land Cruiser.
This guy does it on his kitchen table
This guy does it in an afternoon in a white shirt and a tie, and he doesn't get the shirt dirty.
That's great.
It's so obnoxious. No, it's actually a really cool video. It's this guy, I guess he says in the video, his name's Bobby, I think, but he's new to working at Dave's and obviously knows what he's doing. Seems like a pretty young guy, but obviously knows what he's doing around rebuilding engines. So he talks through everything he does to set this engine up, and it's fascinating. The thing I really liked about it, other than the fact that it was the same engine, you know, and it's kind of obnoxious to see it done quickly, the thing I really liked about it was watching the amount of detail that he put into it reminded me why I was having somebody else do it. Not saying that I couldn't do it, I'm not, but building an engine like that, or any engine, I guess, there's a lot to it. And if you don't know what you don't know, then you don't have any idea how complicated and how precise it actually needs to be. So, you know, it was kind of eye-opening to see that. It's also just cool to watch somebody who's really good at something do what they do, you know, and you can tell this kid, he's younger than I am, this guy really knows what he's talking about, and he does it like looking slick. He's got a bow tie on and a white dress shirt, and he gets to the very end of it. He doesn't get the shirt dirty the entire time. He gets to the very last shot and he takes his gloves with grease and stuff all over him, and he just like wipes him down his shirt, and he goes, "Don't tell my mom."
I thought you were gonna say like he eats a plate of spaghetti and just gets it covered with.
He wipes it down his shirt and he goes, "Don't tell my mom," and that's the end of the video.
Oh, nice!
It was really funny, but yeah, that's a good one. Cool. You guys got anything else for this week?
Oh, that's it. I've been working a lot on the Cadillac since we're doing some car talk. And I'm doing engine stuff I've never done before. I changed the valve or loosened the valve that was stuck, and we're deep into the engine. Lots of parts are on their way in: brakes, engine, oil pump. This is a big one. So I'm deep into this Cadillac, and while we've been on the phone, I'm fiddling because I remembered I wanted to find body mounts. So I need to put rubber grommets between the body mounts and the frame I'm about to build in the spot that doesn't exist. So you guys know this car does not have a. Doesn't have a back on it. Somebody cut the meat of this car off somewhere along the way, and I'm going to rebuild it into a Woody. So I might do a series of videos because to do all this in one video is just too much. So I'm going to break it up. So I want to start doing the body mounts for the addition on the car, which doesn't exist. So I think once I do those parts, I think I might have enough for video one. So I need rubber grommets to bolt on the steel that's going to become parts of the body. A lot of cutting and removing stuff. And something was dead in it. We could not find the dead thing.
Mm.
Shout out to Kurt for helping us find the dead thing in the headliner. Kurt Bloom came over. He was here for the stained glass class. So one night we were fiddling around and
we immediately put it in epoxy.
No. We couldn't find it. We just found this puff of horribly smelling things. We never. It was well. Kirk found it. We cut out the headliner of the car, and it's crazy because the seats are like an old. It's a 1947, so the seat looks like an interior home couch, and these little tiny white filling. It's probably organic material from the 40s, right? It wouldn't be fake at that point. is pulled out and turned into the nest. So mice, over the course of many years, pulled out a little bit of the stuff, then ran up into the headliner, deposited there. Oh. And there was like enough to make like a human hair wig up in the headliner with all the bad smells. So we cut it all out, got rid of it. So now the car's smelling like old rusty metal again, the way it should.
The way it should. The way God intended.
That's right.
I'll send you guys some pictures. Funny.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
And, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you
next time. Love you.